suffering was particularly bad, ironically, dangerously, in the capital. Petrograd, as St. Petersburg became patriotically renamed. In this city, shops often closed early because they had nothing to sell. Bread stores shut early because there was no bread, there was no sugar, there was no meat, there were no provisions. Shops closed. Lines grew for what remained at the few stores that remained open, and people would rush early in the morning in the often dark and cold of winter to wait for what few goods likely existed in stores. Due to inflation and shortages, it also became increasingly difficult to afford, for especially urban lower class Russians, the prices of what existed in these shops, which wasn't much. And many people were turned to various desperate measures, not able to afford coal or even the wood that would be sold to keep the stoves in people's homes warm, again, especially during the winter, which is long in Russia. They began to tear down wooden fences, tear wood off the outside of buildings just to keep warm. Large numbers of Russians could be seen during the war in the capital city itself, begging just to get by, and large numbers of women turned to prostitution, and many men as well as women turned to crime. Anything to survive in these horrible conditions. Adding to all these problems were the political decisions made by the Tsar and his government. At this time of unprecedented national crisis, the Tsar refused repeated appeals by liberals to involve citizens in policy, as participants in some way in government, by choosing leading officials, leading members of civil society, perhaps for his cabinet, at least for his advisors. Instead, fairly typically, Nicholas retreated further and further into his personalized ideal of rulership, the notion that he alone knew best what was right for his people. He didn't need to hear the advice of anybody, save, of course, God. And a symbol of this whole approach was his decision in the summer of 1915, as we've mentioned before, to take personal command of the army. It's worth noting that most of his ministers advised him that this would not be a good idea. He should stay in the capital. He shouldn't be the commander-in-chief of the army. But Nicholas, as you know, was convinced that his presence would inspire the troops in the way that no other leader could and lead to certain victory. And this decision had two very important consequences. One, it associated Nicholas personally with Russia's poor performance at the front. No longer could anyone say, the Tsar is far away, he doesn't know how bad it is. He had to be seen now as personally responsible for when things were not going well at the front, even when it was only a stalemate. Also, and in the eyes of many Russians, this was far worse, by leaving the capital, he gave a great deal of real, everyday political power to two people, to his wife, Alexandra, and many Russians were beginning to refer to her as the German Empress, given where she was born, and begin to question her loyalty. After all, she had family ties to the German government itself, and the other person being Rasputin, the charismatic holy man who we know advised both Nicholas and Alexandra, and especially became active in the court and advising Alexandra while Nicholas was away. Many people viewed him as nothing but a debauched opportunist, not even a truly religious figure, and yet, as we know, Nicholas saw him as a voice of God and even a voice of the common people. Not surprisingly, this continued carnage at the front, the heightened economic suffering at the rear, and this political rigidity by the Tsar's government contributed to reviving and intensifying a civic protest. Most ominously, given where they were located near the centers of power, we see this among the urban lower classes. Already, in fact, in 1915, discontent, especially with economic conditions, was leading to a growing strike movement, notwithstanding the fact that strikes were illegal during the time of war and workers knew that they could be sent to the front simply for going out on strike. The main issues in these strikes were economic. Indeed, they were about fundamental survival, wages enough to afford supplies, and simply demands for food, that somehow the stores have goods that they could buy and afford. Increasingly, though, workers began to make political demands, saying we needed an end to the war causing these problems. We need a democratic government where people's voices can be heard. We need greater freedom. In other words, demands to change the conditions, the political conditions, leading to their material, their economic suffering.